The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning to you all. This is Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call in Singapore, wishing you a wonderful week ahead and actually hoping that you had a great weekend behind. I'm sure the weekend was better than the news that accompanied it, but anyway, the United States of America. Yes, your country is our main focus here on the Wake Up Call. Most of my listeners are American. So let's take an overview of life in America. What we see is the sum total of life in the U.S. giving way to desperation, delusion, and an irresistible impulse to commit national suicide, or back to what I used to call the national death wish on my old discussion group of a Sunday evening here on PRN. The economy turns sour, the military becomes malignant, households are corrupt, bankrupt, and dependent. Even the churches sing their alleluias to Caesar now. What is national suicide? Well, it's what powerful and once successful nations commit. If no other power arises to kill them, they kill themselves. China may well eventually crush the U.S. militarily in the distant future, but the U.S. can't wait. It lets the zombies run wild. At home, Congress debates a debt ceiling measure as if it made any difference. They've raised the ceiling 93 times since they first imposed a debt ceiling 94 years ago. What are the odds that they will hold the line this time? Zero. Instead, they'll continue borrowing and spending until the nation goes broke. Count on it. The U.S. economy was a free market success story for 100 years, from the end of the U.S. war between the states to the end of the Vietnam War. It was the richest, fastest growing, most innovative, most competitive, and most admired economy in the world. But then, as we saw last week in 1971, Richard Nixon replaced a more or less solid dollar backed by gold with a pure paper dollar backed by nothing but the good intentions of government employees. As the money went, so went the nation. According to Byron King, and I quote, "The problem with the U.S. over the last 40 or 50 years is that there's too much free money. We raise three generations of population who are untied from the basics of monetary education, millions of minds poisoned by Economics 101 in universities across the land, elastic currency, courtesy of the Fed. Media and political classes are no smarter than the dummies who walk the land, so they make policy based on free money from the Fed. Deficits don't matter. Currency circulates and inflates the general price levels. People learn to live with it, even make a virtue of it, doing things like buy as much house as you can afford. The market will rise and you'll make money. That kind of idiocy. There's all this excess currency sloshing around the economy, leading to people doing stupid things like drugs, too much alcohol, divorce, chercher les femmes, food, obesity, theft, etc. Wars cost much silver," wrote Sun Tzu. Lack of money kept a lot of nations out of a lot of trouble over the years. Not anymore. Who needs silver when you can just print out bricks of paper cash and fly it over to Iraq and such? Kind of gives a whole new meaning to the term American exceptionalism. Yep, we're exceptional, that's for sure. More prisoners in jail than anywhere else. We fight longer wars than anywhere else, and we don't win. We give more welfare to more idle people than anywhere else on earth, and we're proud of it. There's so much money that we don't know how to say no. No limits, just raise the debt ceiling. Spend until you can't spend anymore, then spend some more. Well, there are no limits until there are limits. Per Ayn Rand, and I quote, "You can avoid reality, but you cannot avoid the consequences of avoiding reality." End of quote. In the space of 40 years, the U.S. lost its winning ways. Real hourly wages stopped growing in 1973. Stock prices, in real terms, peaked out in 1999, about the same time that real per capita private sector growth came to a halt. The number of full-time jobs topped out about 2 years later, and housing hit its peak in 2007. Abroad, U.S. armed forces continue to squander the most magnificent advantage that a military has ever had. The Pentagon spends 7 times as much as the next biggest spender, and it doesn't even have a worthy opponent. Where does it get the money? It borrows from the Chinese. And what does it do with all that money? It engages in pointless, blood-sucking zombie wars. Its 3 current engagements alone are expected to cost $4 trillion, according to the latest independent estimates, about as much as its trade deficit over the last 10 years. Ask your neighbors, what strategic advantage does the U.S. gain from fighting in Afghanistan, Iraq, or Libya? They will have no good answer. Probably some claptrap about fighting terrorism is the best way they will be able to do, and that's what they were told on TV. A 94-year-old retired Army colonel said on the 4th of July, a Silver Star, by the way, a Silver Star winner in World War II, veteran of the Korean War, when asked what he thought of the Pentagon's strategy in North Africa and the Middle East, said, "I am disgusted. Those guys don't know what they're doing. We have no business getting involved in these things, especially in Libya. They're just traps. I have arguments about it when I go to the VA hospital. The young guys, you know, the ones in their 80s, are in favor of these wars. Wave the flag, rah, rah, let's go in and do the job, teach them a lesson, that sort of thing. But real war is not a football game, and nobody learns anything except not to do it again." End of quote. Well, who, with the exception of a 94-year-old veteran, objects to squandering the national treasure, blood, and honor on these wars? Almost no one. Why not? Because they've all drunk deeply from the intoxicating cup of imperial power. An ordinary nation fights wars to protect itself. An empire fights wars because that's what an empire does. And it continues fighting until it finally beats itself. Why didn't Rome pull back its troops from the Rhine or Anatolia or North Africa in order to protect its homeland from the barbarians? Why didn't Alexander retire to Macedonia while he still had breath? Why didn't the Germans retreat to the banks of the Oder when they still had the means to resist the Soviet onslaught? Why doesn't the U.S. bring home its troops, cut its spending, balance its budget, and protect its future? Ha ha, you know the answer. Because the system has been taken over by zombies. People who want to see the spending continue, no matter what the cost. Zombie wars, zombie social spending, and zombie finance. And every time we look at it, we see more evidence. California, the West Coast, Greece is going broke. And guess why? From Bloomberg, and I quote, "California prison psychiatrist paid $838,706, data shows. July 5th, Bloomberg. A chief psychiatrist for California's overcrowded prison system was paid $838,706 in 2010, more than any other state employee that year, according to payroll figures released today. The doctor, whose name wasn't released, had a salary range of $261,408 to $308,640, according to data released by Comptroller John Chang. The total compensation was raised either by bonuses or payout of unused vacation time or sick days, according to the Comptroller's office. The 10 highest paid state employees each earned more than $500,000 in the 2010 calendar year, for a total of $6.2 million, the figures show. All except three were a prison doctor or dentist. The most populous U.S. state runs the nation's largest correctional system with about 163,000 inmates and is at 175% of capacity, according to the Corrections and Rehabilitation Department. And here's a headline from the Financial Times, and I quote, "The state is now the dominant force in U.S. capital markets." The article goes on to explain that American capitalism is now dominated by credit provided by the U.S. government. For the first time ever, the feds are, quote, "the biggest source of outstanding home mortgage and consumer credit loans in the U.S., end of quote. What do you call a free market economy where the major source of financing comes from the government? Oh, and how about this headline from the International Herald Tribune? "For Mexicans, home is now an option." The point of the article is that Mexicans no longer see the U.S. as the land of opportunity. They see more opportunity in Mexico. According to some estimates, there are now more of them sneaking across the Rio Grande to go home than there are coming to the U.S. "Illegal immigration to the U.S. sputters," continues the headline, which means the U.S. is in greater danger than we thought. Illegal immigrants were the last real Americans. They came to work like the first real Americans. In the Washington area, they're the ones who do the real work. Almost everyone else is a zombie on the government payroll in one way or another. Here's an item from the website Gawker that helps understand how the zombies operate. John Cook. "The White House released its annual salary report last week, and, as usual, it's nice to work for Barack Obama. Most staffers who were there for more than a year got a salary bump. A bigger one than you did. The last time we checked in on White House salaries, we found that an astonishing 75% of continuing staffers got raises from 2009 to 2010, a huge number given the fact that, according to compensation experts, most companies had skipped routine raises that year in reaction to the economic crisis that the White House says was busy failing to solve. This time around, from 2010 to 2011, the ratio is a little less dramatic. Of the 270 White House staffers who have been there for more than a year, 146, or 54%, received raises. The average salary increase was 8%. If you look at only the staffers who got raises, the average increase was twice that. That's a much bigger raise than the average white-collar worker got. According to a survey conducted last year by the human resources conducting firm Mercer, most firms were projecting a 3% increase in base pay for executives. White House workers did nearly three times as well. One of Obama's first acts as president was to freeze the salaries of all White House officials earning more than $100,000 because, quote, "during this period of economic emergency, families are tightening their belts and so should Washington," end of quote. 2 years later, he extended that policy to all federal workers using the same logic. Quote, "small businesses and families are tightening their belts. Their government should too," end of quote. but the across-the-board freeze didn't take effect until January 1, 2011, so the most recent report, which goes back to July 2010, features some eye-opening raises, like Special Assistant to the President for Economic Policy Matthew Fogel's $59,000, 82% raise to an annual salary of $130,500. Or Director of American or African American Media Levin Lewis's $36,000, 86% pay hike. How about that? A director of African American media on the White House payroll. Just what the country needs. Oh, well. Let me give you my information, ladies and gentlemen, very quickly. I am Richard Martin. This is the Wake Up Call. It's coming to you from glorious Singapore. And the time is now 11:17 p.m. in Singapore, 11:17 a.m. on the east coast of the United States of America. And it is Monday, July the 11th. You may call, and you may use our toll-free number to call with your comments and your observations of one sort or another. And the number to call would be 888-874-4888. That number has been, frankly, dead for the last few weeks, but let someone bring it to life. I should be glad to hear from you. Once again, the number is 888-874-4888. Your call will cost you exactly zero. You may also email us by emailing me, at my personal email address, which is rm@gfawd.com. And that's RM for Richard Martin at GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design.com. Once more, email address rm@gfawd.com. Finally, if you want to call me in private to express your concerns and anxieties about your personal situation, which more and more people are doing these days, and tragic though it sounds, I do my best to deal with these queries, and you are very welcome to call me. And my number here, my direct line through Sarasota, Florida, is area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. Okay, well, Frank Devlin brought to my attention this, which I thought was interesting. Folks, you just can't make this stuff up. On July the 6th, just 2 days ago, at least a dozen busybody congressmen sponsored the introduction of H.R. 2411, the Reduce America's Debt Now Act of 2011. They always come up with fantastic names for these pieces of legislation, and rest assured, the better or more patriotic the name, the more ominous the bill. This one follows the pattern. H.R. 2411 states that every worker in America should be able to voluntarily have a portion of his or her wages automatically withheld and sent directly to the Treasury Department for the purposes of paying down the federal debt. Quote, every employer making payment of wages shall deduct and withhold upon such wages any amounts so elected and shall pay such amounts over to the Secretary of the Treasury. End of quote. That's right. Uncle Sam is so broke that he wants to give all the good little Americans out there the opportunity to contribute an even greater portion of their paychecks to finance government largesse. Desperate? Don't worry, it gets better. Obviously, if an employee feels so compelled and should elect to have a portion of his or her paycheck withheld, the onus of responsibility is now on the employer to make it happen. The employer has to do all the paperwork, withhold the money, send the payment to the Treasury, maintain the account records, and probably submit to all kinds of new filing requirements. You can imagine that, if passed, the bill will result in a whole host of new IRS regulations, complete with a battery of penalties for employers who don't fill out the paperwork properly, submit filings on time, or make some administrative mistake. Think about it. If a small business owner has one single employee who is dumb enough to think that it's his patriotic duty to pay down the debt and decides to contribute $1 a month, that owner will have the responsibility for all kinds of new forms and filings, plus submit to new debt reduction audits. But don't worry, it gets even better. So, let's say there are millions of sheep out there who elect to donate a portion of their toil and sweat so that the Chinese and big financial institutions don't have to worry about an American default. How does Congress plan on rewarding its most patriotic citizens? By sticking it to them on their taxes, of course. H.R. 2011 stipulates that any contribution made to the Treasury in order to pay down the federal debt is not tax deductible. Quote, the Treasury Secretary shall include a reasonably conspicuous statement that any amounts deducted and withheld from wages are not deductible as charitable contributions for federal income tax purposes. Imagine this scenario. You make $100,000 a year. In a fit of complete insanity, you decide that you want to withhold your entire annual salary to pay down the debt. Hey, you can always move in with Mum for the next year, right? Well, guess what? Uncle Sam will gladly take your money and then still expect you to pay taxes on the $100,000 that you earned. So you'd have to cough up an additional $40,000 or so. Don't worry, though. The Social Security and Medicare wages are reduced by the amount that you withhold, making you only liable for state and federal taxes. Seems like a good deal, eh, comrades? There are so many things utterly wrong with this piece of legislation, it's hard to know where to begin, other than by saying that such intellectual and philosophical perversion is only capable of springing from such unprincipled sociopaths whose sole capability is the destruction of value. There's a great quote from Atlas Shrugged that comes to mind which sums this all up. When you see that in order to produce, you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing. When you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods, but in favors. When you see that men get rich more easily by graft than by work. And your laws no longer protect you against them, but protect them against you, you may know that your society is doomed. End of quote. Well, we've discussed the story of the boiling frog so many times before. That's the frog which, when put in a pot of water and slowly brought to a boil, doesn't realize that he's in danger and that it's too late. I think the boiling frog just got a little hotter. Have you hit your breaking point yet? Okay, well, a couple of emails before we go to our break. Rosemary Ottica wrote in. She said, "Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for your program. On TV, I saw that thieves were stealing air conditioners right off their pads at private homes and apartments. It's just as you said, Rosemary Ottica." Well, that's Rosemary's contribution. And now we have Andy Celsius, who wrote in a few moments ago saying, "Do the laws of physics apply to equities?" That's a very interesting question, as a matter of fact, Andy, because I heard it said that there is a law of momentum, which you actually ask about in the next part of your question. But momentum is, in fact, the idea of throwing a ball in the air, and the momentum then just is forced, ball comes crashing back to Earth again. There is a school of thought which believes that that is what happens, and I actually do subscribe to it. You've got to interpret it intelligently. You cannot just think, oh, stock market's gone up, now it's going to come crashing down. But in the general sense, there is a whole host of what we call internal indicators in the market which top out before an external market top comes into play. And I think we just saw that last week, as a matter of fact, in this particular market. I think we're headed down from here, and I think that those people who are interested in taking advantage of that downturn should be in position by now, because I think it's going to be very profitable. So that's one part of your question, a good part, Andy, and then you say after that, I often hear analysts, for example, Cramer, use the term momentum when speaking about a stock. What are they talking about, really? No, it's a serious interpretation of the movement of a market, Andy. Momentum does apply, and it applies also on the downside, like a bouncing ball. When the ball falls so hard that it hits the ground and then has to move in another direction, that direction is always up. You see that frequently in day trading in the stock market, when the market collapses a huge amount and then has a technical, what we call a technical bounce. That is the momentum of the stock having hit a low point and then bouncing off that point, which is, you know, another interpretation of momentum on the downside. And it actually is valid, and it works both on the down and upside. And if you interpret it correctly, it helps enormously in analyzing where the stock market is going. So thanks for the question there, Andy. It was certainly very apt and appreciated. All right, well, we're a couple of minutes early here, and if Matt is paying attention and wishes to now go to break, I think we would do that, because then we could move on with the next thrilling episode of our wake-up call here. And so this is Richard, and I will be right back.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Why should you be listening to the Progressive Radio Network? Here are a few hosts that call PRN home. Award-winning investigative journalist and documentary filmmaker Michael Ruper. Acclaimed theoretical physicist Michio Kaku. Notable media critic and international journalist, the news dissector, Danny Schechter. Leading progressive journalists such as Stephen Ledman, John Rappaport, and Glenn Ford have also found a home with us. We also have advice from Richard Martin on how to protect yourself from the ongoing financial collapse. John Mueller tells us his firsthand account on moving out of the U.S. and making a new life for himself in another country on his show, The Expat Files. Along with all these informative programs, we also have health shows hosted by America's top doctors like Mayor Eisenstein, Cheryl Selman, and, of course, Gary Null. The Progressive Radio Network is the place for news and information.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. And click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kiss the smile upon her face.
Join me, Rachel Trachtenberg for Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination. This is a show for everyone from our perspective as teens. Current events, art as life, music, and politics. Rachel Trachtenberg's Pure Imagination.
With co-host Julia Cunning.
Wednesdays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Not bad.
Not too shabby.
Are you struggling to survive the Great Recession? Frustrated by everyone from the big banks to the politicians? You need the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown.
We bring common sense to the chaotic world of bank bailouts, financial crises, currency wars, precious metals, and government regulations.
Plus, we touch on many of the major news items of the day from a freedom-oriented perspective, and we aren't shy about our opinions.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Jake Towne.
And I'm Gene DiNardo.
It all happens Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you then, everybody.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Okay, we are back. And just came in. I don't know how this happened. Okay, I got in an email from Kim Maslin into my junk email folder. I seldom get any junk these days, so I don't know whether this is a special moment in time for you, Kim, but anyway, I caught it, and so here it is, your email. Hi, Richard. So glad I listened to your show, but I think we may have missed the deadline. My husband and I, children are grown, have our home up for sale in Michigan and are waiting for it to sell. While waiting, I have been employed in minimum wage jobs. I am 53. My husband will be 60. My question is, should I go back to school for 2 years to get my bachelor's degree, which would enable me to get a better job when we move? Plus, this is in a high-demand field, and I plan on working for many years to come while my husband is retired. We're thinking of moving to Canada. We would like to go to South America, but we have three dogs that we can't part with, and we're worried that we cannot work in South America, and therefore, what do you do all day long if not working? Okay, good. Some interesting meat grist for the mill here, Kim. First of all, do not go back to school. No, it's a waste of time. I do not believe that a bachelor's degree will help you in this environment get any kind of job at all. I think truly, unless you really want to study, you're going to be spinning your wheels for nothing. And I feel quite strongly about that. So fortunately, that's an easy one. I don't think it will enable you to get a job, I think if you really are in a high-demand field, you don't say what it is, I am quite confident that you will be able to get work in South America. My strong advice to you is to go to either Brazil or Argentina. These are big countries where there's a lot of demand for a lot of different things, and I feel very confident indeed that you will find a job if you go to the big centers like Buenos Aires or Sao Paulo or Rio. You should be able to find work really quite easily. That is my opinion. I might be wrong, but if I were you, I would talk to some of these people in websites who deal with foreigners, like international living. If you want to write that down, it's all one word, internationalliving.com. They have representatives in various different South American countries, and they really should be able to help you. I would have thought you should be able to take your dogs in. I had not heard about quarantine problems with dogs. And as far as what you do all day long, if you're not working, you look for work. Much easier, I would say, for qualified people or people at least from countries like the U.S. to find work than even for local people. So I wouldn't worry about it. Just go. Just go. Okay, so I think I need to talk to you, ladies and gentlemen, about the unemployment figures on Friday because, frankly, they were a game changer. They truly were. They don't always matter that much, and even if they are very significant, they don't necessarily matter that much, but this particular month, they really do matter. The unemployment data that came out on Friday for the month of June suggests that we are actually experiencing something far worse than the mere bump in the road, as the President described it last month. In fact, if last month was the time to panic, as Stephanie Kelton argued, then today's data should create real palpitations in the White House. This isn't just a bump, but a fully-fledged New York City-style pothole. First, in the headline number everyone looks at, non-farm payrolls, up 18,000 in June. The increase was 100,000 less than expectations. In addition, the prior two-month payroll increases were revised down by 44,000 overall. Well, that's weak, but not terrible. But dig a bit deeper into the data, and it looks absolutely awful. The household measure of employment fell by 445,000. Okay, that's a noisy number, but as Frank Veneroso has pointed out, this measure of employment, which is never revised, now shows no employment growth over the last 5 months and very negative employment growth over the last three. But it gets worse. The work week was down one-tenth. Overtime was down one-tenth. The labor participation rate at 64.1% was the lowest since 1984. The broad U6 unemployment rate rose from 15.8 to 16.2%. In other words, as Frank suggested, quote, many other employment indicators in this report confirm the deep disappointment in the payroll series and the much more negative message of the household series. End of quote. Well, let's have a look around. Spain's unemployment rate is 21%. Greece, which has just implemented yet another round of cuts in government spending, has an unemployment rate above 16% and trending sharply higher. And Italy is finally coming up in the headlines. Per capita income in that country has grown 0% over the last decade. Today, the Bank of France put out their monthly business survey, and I quote, industrial activity declined in June due to the weaker performance of the automotive, equipment manufacturing, and other industrial goods sectors. The capacity utilization rate fell. Order books were still considered to be above normal levels, but appear to be in a less favorable position than in past months. End of quote. That's the core, not just the periphery. It's no longer just a problem of the Mediterranean profligates. The collective embrace of fiscal austerity has gone beyond perverse. It's as if Josef Mengele was reborn as an economist working on some weird new social experiment to inflict the maximum amount of damage on the maximum amount of people. It's a sick variation on that old joke. Patient. Doctor, it hurts when I do this. Doctor, then keep doing it. Well, things are going to get a whole lot worse, ladies and gentlemen. More job cuts are coming. One recently released report found that the number of job cuts being planned by U.S. employers increased by 11.6% in June. It is also being projected that state and local governments across the U.S. will slash nearly 500,000 more jobs by the end of next year. A grand total of 18,000 jobs were added last month, which was the most feeble increase since September of last year. Moreover, the two previous months were revised downwards by 29,000 in May and 15,000 in April. The private sector generated 57,000 jobs, while government at all levels subtracted an aggregate 39,000. The unemployment rate edged up to 9.2% from May's 9.1% and would have been a bit higher but for the shrinkage in the labor pool, which occurred likely as not because more folks without a job got discouraged and stopped looking for one. Even working stiffs had something tangible to beef about. Earnings in June fell a penny an hour, and the work week contracted as well. The household survey, which showed a loss of 445,000 jobs, and even adjusting to match the payroll concept, was down a not inconsiderable 401,000. The rise in unemployment was most emphatic. At the extremes of the duration spectrum, which includes those jobless 5 weeks or less at one end and people out of work for 99 weeks or more. The increase in the ranks of the newly unemployed was especially alarming. Alarming as well is the rise in U6, which includes both the unemployed and underemployed, from 15.8% to 16.2%. This is the all-inclusive category, and it hasn't been this high since December. And while there are roughly 14 million people out of work by the usual count of unemployment, there are some 25 million by the U6 measure. Ladies and gentlemen, that translates into an awful lot of unhappy people. David Rosenberg calls the unemployment report a mega reality check. He views the jobs tally as horrible, not just the headline, but also the details. While he agrees that employment did pick up somewhat earlier this year, the uptick was largely in response, quote, to the psychological effects of illusionary prosperity inspired by the monetary and fiscal largesse unleashed last fall. As it emerges, these stimuli give the economy a brief sugar high with no lasting multiplier effect. The economy, he says, is in a very fragile state. Particularly rare is to see an economy that's supposedly well into recovery produce the likes of a puny 18,000 monthly job gain. For a real recovery, celebrating its second anniversary, you would expect employment to rise more on the order of 180,000. It's hard to overlook that missing zero in Friday's headlines. Rosenberg notes that the total of unemployed in June swelled by 173,000 and exceeded 14 million for the first time this year. Including discouraged workers, the pool of available labor soared by 480,000 to 20.6 million, which works out to seven people vying for every job opening. The normal ratio is close to three. Prospects for a rebound in July are not great, he says. In the June report, virtually all the telltale indicators of what's ahead, temporary hiring, the decline in the work week, since hours tend to lead bodies and the revisions, which have a habit of feeding on themselves, were negative. In his summing up, Rosenberg points out that, quote, here we are, 2 years into an economic recovery, and the level of employment at 131 million is actually lower than it was in March 2000. At this stage of the cycle, what is normal is that payrolls are making new cyclical highs. This time round, barely 20% of the recession losses have been recouped. End of quote. He scoffs at the myopic attention paid to a second half revival, which he considers a, quote, classic failure to look at the forest past the trees, end of quote. Well, sadly enough, the U.S. economy is saddled with numerous structural headwinds, from excessive non-corporate debt, excessive housing inventories, excessive reliance on imported oil, and excessive labor market supply. Very grim indeed, ladies and gentlemen. Well, let me spend a few moments explaining to you how money has been transformed from an instrument of change into an instrument of confiscation of labor and property. Here is how it works. First, understand the basics. Suppose you own the only printing press in town and that you obtained monopoly and a license to print money in your town. This money is legal tender, i.e. the only money allowed in town. Everybody will come to you to obtain money as a medium of exchange. You will print the money on request, but only in the form of credit with interest attached to it as payment for your printing services. And you will, where you can, obtain mortgage on other security interest on property of debtors. Suppose a client comes to you and asks for $100 for 5 years. You will agree to print the $100 bill upon signature of your client's promise to pay you the money and pay you annual interest, say 10%, i.e. $10 per year, for 5 years. You will also ask the client to give you a mortgage on his house. Once you obtain the signature, you will print only the requested $100 bill. You will not print the $5-$10 bill to cover the future interest that your current client has to pay you. Please note that a second before you print the bill, you didn't have it. So basically, you legally counterfeited the bill based on your license and obtained mortgage on your client's house. In a year's time, your client will have to pay you $10 of interest. But there exists in circulation only $100 the bill you printed. The $10 bill doesn't exist. Therefore, and because you print money only in the form of interest-bearing credit, which is debt, you will only print the additional $10 bill only in the form of new debt. Interest, therefore, increases the money supply in your town and dilutes over time the relative value of money you already printed and put in circulation in the form of debt, which is the basic cause of inflation. On the other hand, interest represents the additional goods and or services your client needs to produce for your benefit. Now, in this example, the value total, or the value rather of total additional work your client has to perform over 5 years, will reach $50, which is half of the value of the $100 bill you printed initially out of nothing, and which your client will also have to repay you. Not bad at all. Of course, your client's customers will also have to come to you for credit to pay your client for his goods and or services, so he can pay you interest and repay the principal. And of course, they will also owe you interest. In this way, interest will keep compounding and inflate all prices, as the economy of the town will have to keep compensating interest payable to you by constantly rising prices. You realize now that you become the most powerful person in town, and you don't care which politicians run it. Everybody in town now thinks that they need your services and need the money you print. You can cause booms and busts by manipulating interest rates and by deciding to print or not print your money and to whom you issue notes or not. You see now that your monopoly on counterfeiting money in the form of debt with interest attached gives you huge power. Actually, you wouldn't care less to have any of your clients go bankrupt. Better than that, in case of your client's bankruptcy, which you can yourself cause by refusing to further credit him, you will obtain his property. You do not have any risk, as you yourself print the money. Of course, you will credit him and you will obtain his property. You do not have any risk, as you yourself print the money. Of course, you will do everything to keep your little fraud going and people comply with it. This scheme exhibits exponential growth pattern, ultimately uncontrollable even by its masters, and it is prone to abuse and fraud. One can only wonder why anybody in such a town would agree to go on with it, unless the town's politicians are bribed. However, this is the precise scheme upon which the whole money system has worked for decades now, with your uninformed consent and compliance. Today, of course, more than 95% of all money is created electronically out of nothing, so no need even to actually print the notes, apart from some physical cash to maintain the illusion of money. So here is how this scheme translates in everyday life and on a global scale. Let's start with the central banks, which were created long ago and owned by private banks, such as, among others, the Fed and the Bank of England. These central banks generate electronic sets of numbers and call them money. They then purchase, with this newly created money, government and other interest-bearing debt, various bonds and notes, etc., i.e. promises to pay, issued by governments on your behalf. This operation can be done either directly or indirectly through the financial markets. In fact, governments back this debt and the attached interest by introducing taxes at different times and in different places. Today, more than half of all government tax income goes to pay interest on government debt. Due to the compounding of interest embedded in the system, this debt grows exponentially. This means that the commercial banks are direct ultimate recipients of a huge chunk of revenue you earn from your collective labor, which is confiscated from you in the form of government taxes. No wonder why central banks surround themselves with such an aura of secrecy and remain unaccountable to anybody. Governments act as agents of what are, in effect, legal counterfeiters. But this is only a small part of the story. So now, let's talk about the private or the commercial banks. The so-called money thus created as interest-bearing debt by central banks is then deposited with other private commercial and other banks which control central banks. These deposits are then arbitrarily called bank reserves. Based on the fractional reserve model, banks then multiply this so-called money by more than tenfold in the form of new debt. This means that on every dollar or euro, franc or any other currency of reserves, the banks issue more than $10 of new interest-bearing money in the form of private, corporate, and further government debt. And by the way, this also applies to your private deposits you deposit with your banks. They're not really deposits, but rather loans you give to the banks, loans which they immediately multiply in the form of further debt. Actually, the entire banking system today is in a complete and permanent state of bankruptcy. Only very few people understand it. You could never get out your savings if more than a small fraction of what you want to, if you want to take out of your money at the same time. This money simply doesn't exist. This new debt is backed solely by the promise to pay, the principal and the attached interest, for example, by the loan agreements you sign when asking for credit of any form or purpose. And depending on the type of debt, by mortgage or other type of security on property, in whatever form and the value of the underlying assets, such as subprimes, which suit the banks. Therefore, not only the whole economy then spends energy to pay the interest on what is really nothing more than counterfeit money, the economy's participants, including you, willingly transfer property rights to banks for the money, the latter counterfeit legally. They then dare to call this credit a lifeblood of the economy, when in reality it is its worst cancer. As in the simple experience with the town, money to cover the interest can only be created in the form of further interest-bearing debt. In this way, the sum of all the principal and interest is always greater than the principal of the debt. Irrespective of the level of growth, no physical economy can accommodate, with the perpetual lack of money, to cover the ever-growing debt and interest payments. The economies of the world are simply eating themselves out, trying to cope with the cancer-type growth of the debt and resulting interest. So, ladies and gentlemen, you can see now that all money in circulation today is debt, and it grows exponentially due to perpetually compounded interest. No bank reserve ratios nor any other stable money standard can be sustained under such a system. Moreover, no human real economy can physically keep up with an exponential mathematical model. The more interest is compounded in the economy, the more it has to discard jobs and downscale quality of products and services to compensate the growing interest payments. The truth is that this debt can never be repaid nor otherwise cancelled without the destruction of the bankers' system of slavery, which, of course, they want to keep at any cost. After all the damage already done, the whole world is stalling and choking from ever-growing doses of interest poison. But the elites do not want to come to their senses and keep on fooling everybody and themselves with their so-called recovery, austerity measures, balanced budgets, and other tales, which obviously have nothing to do with reality. All these tales are indeed their smokescreen. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you were paying attention and you really understood everything I said just now, a horrible realization will have come over you. You will get it fairly and squarely that this system is going to fail and that the implosion of economies worldwide is guaranteed and absolute. And you will take the measures that you need to take to protect yourselves, because there is no hope for the system, ladies and gentlemen. Now, what I just said to you, which basically comes pretty much as from the break, a little bit after the break, if you did not get it the first time, I absolutely urge you to listen to it again in the archives. Because if you understand what I just said, you will be among the wisest 1% of the population on the planet. No mass media will go near the arguments that I have just come up with. They will give you absolutely no help whatsoever in understanding this vital aspect of economics. And it actually doesn't take a study of economics to understand this. It just takes a different approach. Instead of falling for the sappy nonsense that is fed to you every day by all manner of media, take a giant step back, ignore the media, understand this, and even when you think you've understood it, listen to it again. Because this is dynamite for you, ladies and gentlemen. If you understand this, you are truly in a position of superiority. And if you then make the changes to your lives that come from a logical understanding of this, you will be in good shape for the depression that is yet to play itself out. And I'm sure all of you understand, especially after the grim unemployment news on Friday, which by horrible paradox coincided with the end of QE2. The one experiment that Bernanke had to offer from his wide research into the causes of the Great Depression, leading to his one conclusion, which is that the system only needed a huge flood of money and everything would have been okay. And as of midnight on June the 30th, ladies and gentlemen, it became absolutely clear to anybody who thinks that that did not happen, that the world is in a grave and grim destiny, and that there is nothing that can save it from here on out. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the news gets worse, and I don't sugarcoat it, and I will not do so. But please feel free. If there is any misunderstandings, call me up and we'll talk about it together. All right, for now, that's it. The hour's up. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye, and I will be back on Friday at the usual time. Take care. See you then.